This weekend starts right after this.
As a small business owner, you need protection for your physical and financial assets. From general and professional liability insurance to business owners and commercial auto policies, GEICO can help. Go to geicocommercial.com for your free quote and see how much you could save today.
From Compass Media Networks, this is America's First News. This weekend, with your host, Gordon Deal.
Things we can't do without. I'm Gordon Deal with Jennifer Koschenka. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. Here's what's coming up this hour.
On the tech front, a list of things you won't be able to live without in the next 15 years, even though we don't have these things now.
With back-to-back World Cup titles under their belts, how much longer can the U.S. women's soccer team dominate? We'll have analysis.
The latest scams making news, cyber crooks posing as your boss in an email asking you for a favor like buying gift cards.
And how Instagram is turning lesser-known locations into social media darlings.
So there's a place called Horseshoe Bend, Arizona, and it's beautiful. It's where the Colorado River kind of winds around a giant sandstone, like monolith. And say 10 years ago, only 40,000 people a year would go there. Right now, it's 2 million.
Wall Street Journal reporter Jim Carlton on places like Horseshoe Bend, seeing enormous spikes in traffic from people seeking selfies. He's here later in the hour. It's time for a business update, and it's brought to you by the Michigan Economic Development Corporation. The businesses of the future are being built today, and Michigan is where they start. Learn more by searching Michigan Pure Opportunity. According to new Pew Research, large majorities of Americans say conversations about politics have become stressful experiences they prefer to avoid, with 85% saying discussions are less respectful and fact-based and more negative than ever. That said, as the 2020 race heats up, can you take steps to protect civil discourse in the workplace? We're joined now by John Baldoni, executive coach and author of a new book called Grace, A Leader's Guide to a Better Us. He's based in Ann Arbor, Michigan. John, give us guidance.
Well, I think politics for smart folks in the workplaces, they avoid it because you don't know where your counterpart size. So it's one of those things where it's best left unsaid. Now, we always used to say that, of course, but now because our national discourse is rancorous with, both sides feel animus toward another, that cannot help but bleed over into the workplace. So I think that the thing is those in management to say, hey, let's avoid the politics, but if we're going to talk it, let's talk civilly. And you could use it as a lesson. You know, let's exchange, open exchange of ideas, just as we do with our projects. And so it's up to management to say, hey, let's use language that reflects our values. Now, if you have a teammate that's out of line on that, you can make it known to him or her that their remarks don't reflect yours. It's okay to have an opinion, but let's keep our language civil. And civility is what built this country. You know, we go back to our founders a lot, and they disagreed with one another's, but they believed in one thing, and that was a unity and a culture, e pluribus unum, from many, one. Mm-hmm. And that's today, but we sort of lost that.
So oftentimes this is easier said than done. If you're a manager, say, trying to lead a discussion on how to be civil, what are you saying to your team?
Well, it's a good thing you say that, because I think employees are looking for that. Research shows that employees want their leaders to take a moral stand on issues. That doesn't mean politics, but stand up for what they believe in right. So when a leader says, or a manager says, look, we're going to discuss this issue, whatever it is, focus on the workplace, let's exchange ideas. It's okay to be disagree, but let's not be disagreeable. Let's make sure we use words that affirm our ideas and affirm the humanity of others, but we don't take wisecracks at others at someone else's expense.
We're speaking with John Baldoni, executive coach and author of a book called Grace, A Leader's Guide to a Better Us, and we're talking about protecting civil discourse in the workplace. If things do get out of hand, I mean, you're talking about ruined chemistry, right? Maybe projects delayed, hurt feelings, people, I don't know, resigning, quitting, lawsuits, lost productivity. I mean, there's many things that can happen, I guess, that could go wrong.
Right, absolutely. And it's not just the discourse. What happens is it reveals an underlying discontent, a disengagement from work. And I always point that this is management's issue. They have not addressed it. But I think people come to work. They don't come to work to fight. They don't come to work to argue. They come to do their best. And so, therefore, it's up to management to create those conditions. But employees have a responsibility, too. It's called reciprocity. If I'm going to be part of this company, I'm going to abide by the rules. I'm going to abide by our values. But you know what, Gordon? It's not so much do's and don'ts. It's about thinking more positively. What can I do to create a better working environment in my own space? I talk about something called creating the culture of service. And it begins with looking how you can help someone else do his or her job, not as a meddler, but as a supporter. And we know this from sports examples, jazz musicians, all this kind of stuff. We can do the same thing in a workplace. Look, hey, someone is struggling with an issue. How can you help them with that? It's that reaching a helping hand. It's an attitudinal thing. That's a positive. It's not a negative. Like, don't do that. It's hey, what can I do? How can I help?
If there's animosity, that's largely, I would imagine, a reflection on the manager and an inability to, provide some sort of workplace where discourse is civil, managed well would, things like that. I'm not saying squash the free speech, but that is a reflection on management, I'd presume.
No, it is a reflection on management, but I'm going to give an individual manager a break. I mean, if someone comes into the workforce with a chip on his or her shoulder and is, acting in a contrary manner all the time, it's up to management to act on it. If they don't, then it's on them. But do I blame the animus that individual holds toward others on the manager? No, I do not. I just say it's up to management to deal with that person and remove that person from that specific workplace. Certainly provide them with coaching or have a conversation that if this behavior continues and explain that this behavior is not simply the ad hominem tax. You, as you said earlier, Gordon, is affecting our productivity. It's affecting our harmony. It's affecting our ability to serve our customers. There is a very much a business case for what comity and civility is all about.
Thanks, John. John Baldoni, executive coach. The new book is called Grace, A Leader's Guide to a Better Us. 13 minutes after the hour on This Weekend.
Michigan is one of the best places in the country to do business. But you don't have to take our word for it. Take Evan Lyles, CEO of Roush Enterprises, instead.
For the people that are involved in product development, there couldn't be more unique and exciting opportunities that are really going to shape the future of the world. It's a really exciting time to be in Michigan.
Big things are happening in business here. Find out why by searching Michigan Pure Opportunity.
On the eastern plains of Texas, local leaders are trying to stop the bleeding of talent to bigger cities. They're sprucing up downtown, completing walking trails, investing in parks and schools, and making other improvements they hope will entice young workers to stay and help that part of the state finally claim a share of what's called the Texas Miracle. Few parts of America have nurtured faster job growth than Texas in the years since the 2008 financial crisis, but that growth has largely left cities like Longview in the dust. Is there a balance to be struck, or is that interfering? It's a story by Jim Tankersley, economic policy reporter at the New York Times. Jim, what did you see in your visit?
Texas, of course, boomed in the wake of the Great Recession, but that most of the job and business creation that happened was really concentrated to four places: Austin, Dallas, Houston, and San Antonio, and that everybody else kind of missed out.
Is that standard operating procedure? I mean, you named, I think, what are probably four of the top 10 largest cities in America, too, right?
Yeah, they are. I mean, what we're looking at here is sort of a pronounced example of a big national trend, which is that large metropolitan areas are really disproportionately, compared to history, capturing the fruits of economic growth in America over the last decade or so. What's happened is that basically talent and investment is flocking to big cities, and so they are the ones adding jobs, they are the ones adding businesses, they are the ones adding people. And while I've written about more of these sort of longer trends in the past, but what has happened before was that a much wider swath of America would see job growth and business growth when times were good. Now you see these sort of superstar, they're called, areas capturing most of that. And even within those areas, it's some very concentrated, like very high-end zip codes, really a case of the rich getting richer. And it's true across the country. It is actually particularly true in Texas. And that's why we wrote the story, because I think that was surprising to me and to a lot of folks.
And why does this happen? Is it sort of is it a snowball effect, basically?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, you know, we're still sort of sorting out everything that's happened, but as you have this sort of rise of the service-based economy in the United States, we do less of making things and more of just doing things for each other and getting paid for it. That advantages a certain type of worker that appears to want to cluster in a certain type of environment. And so I guess the sort of very shorthand way of saying it is you get particular, like, young, call them engineers who graduate from college, who all kind of want to live around each other in hip neighborhoods in like Austin or Dallas, and so the businesses follow them, or you have a big concentration of businesses that they all want to work for. Either way, it's a cycle that repeats and builds on itself, and so you just end up with this massive buildup kind of snowball effect.
We're speaking with Jim Tankersley, economic policy reporter at the New York Times. This piece is called "The Texas Miracle Missed Most of Texas." So is this bad to have these concentrations of talent, as you mentioned, Austin, Dallas, Houston, San Antonio? Do experts say it's problematic because of the gap between these cities and some of the smaller ones that have not done well?
I think there's two reasons why I would call it worrisome. The first is, I mean, I'm a small town kid myself, and I think that small town America should be vibrant, that it's an important part of our national fabric, and that for not just economic reasons but cultural reasons, it's good to have this sort of more places doing well as opposed to just a few places. Resentment can grow. There's just a lot of political, economic, social instability things that can happen when you have large parts of the country that feel like they are dying or treading water, and then other parts that look like they're rocketing ahead. But I think economically, the other thing that we worry about is that, like, it gets very expensive to live in these big places. So it's actually harder to be sort of to hold on to the middle class if you're, you're moving to a city for a good job, but every year your housing costs go up 10%. And that is often the case. It's less of a worry in Texas, frankly, than in like California, where housing prices have just gone through the roof. Yeah. In places like San Francisco. But it's still a real worry, and we are seeing house price appreciation in Austin and Dallas that are faster than we would have expected historically for them.
Assuming that there are folks who would like to see this change, is there anything that actually can be done? I mean, you can't tell a business, for example, not to relocate somewhere, right?
No, I mean, there's all sorts of things that could be done. I went to Longview, Texas, out in East Texas for this, a region that I had never visited before but really enjoyed. And I think that they have they are trying to pull some civic levers to attract young people, in part by appealing to the things, the advantages they have over the bigger areas, like, hey, this is a quieter place to raise a family, where you can have more of an impact in a community, and where you can buy a house sooner and for less money.
Thanks, Jim. Jim Tankersley, economic policy reporter at the New York Times. 22 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend.
LaBelle, Rose up the middle, looking, cutting, shooting, go!
That's my girl, Rose Lavelle. The U.S. women's soccer team continues its World Cup celebration, but how long can the Americans dominate? Here's This Weekend's Jennifer Koshenka.
The U.S. women's soccer team remains the world's best, but the world is catching up. How much longer can the U.S. team keep going? Here to answer that question, Joshua Robinson of the Wall Street Journal. Joshua, who are the veterans on this team?
The veteran that you cannot miss at this tournament was Megan Rapinoe, but she's already 34 years old. You're also looking at someone like Carly Lloyd. I know she only came off the bench in most games, but she's 36 and really an icon of this team. And at the back, people like Becky Sauerbrunner, also 34. Even Alex Morgan, who was the baby-faced assassin of this team for so long, just played at her third World Cup, and she's already 30. So for a lot of women on this team, retirement is beginning to appear on the horizon, and you begin to wonder, is there another World Cup in them? And, even a year away are the Tokyo Olympics, and some of them will wonder if they can last that long.
Have there been any hints from any of them about what they might plan to do?
I think Carly Lloyd, above all, would be the one who's beginning to really think about it. At 36, and not necessarily a key member of Coach Jill Ellis' plans, it could be pretty tempting to hang up her boots when she's at absolutely the pinnacle of the game. The other tempting thing, however, is that because of the way the women's international soccer cycle works, we're in a period where the World Cup is just a year away from the next Olympics. After the Olympics, the next World Cup will be 3 years away. So hanging on for just 12 more months, extremely appealing if you think I could get in this team for Tokyo.
We're speaking with Joshua Robinson of the Wall Street Journal. Talk about the future of Jill Ellis. Where does she stand on her contract, and is she in good standing as the U.S. coach?
She's been criticized a lot at this tournament for some of her tactical choices and some of the decisions she's made in the way she's managed individual games, but you really cannot argue with the results. She's the only coach in women's soccer history to win two World Cups. Even no one has done that on the men's side, even since the 1930s. She's also, and she deserves a lot of credit for this, managed to effectively wrangle the egos and personalities on that team. And we know there are a lot of personalities in that locker room. But she said she's not here to police that, and she's let them speak freely and continue to deliver results. So her contract is up this summer, and there's an option that could be triggered by U.S. soccer or her for another year, and that would take her through the Olympics. She's been very coy about her future so far and says she hasn't made a decision. It's going to be interesting to see whether she decides, again, to go out on a high or roll the dice again in Tokyo and see if she can hold off the advance of the rest of the world one more time.
Joshua, is there anything that goes on between now and the Olympics next summer?
Well, the first order of business as the U.S. women return home is a victory tour. They're going to play, I think, about half a dozen games between August and October all over the country, where they invite some of the best teams in the world to the United States and really bathe in the adulation of American fans. So that'll be the first thing. And then they'll resume their normal calendar and start to get ready for the Olympics.
This weekend's Jennifer Koshenko with Wall Street Journal reporter Joshua Robinson. It's 30 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend.
Michigan is one of the best places in the country to do business. But you don't have to take our word for it. Take Patty Poppes, president and CEO of Consumers Energy, instead.
All of the innovation that's occurring around robotics, AI, it's happening here in Michigan. We have chemical companies, we have pharmaceutical companies, we have medical device manufacturers. Michigan is a magnet for innovators and dreamers.
Big things are happening in business here. Find out why by searching Michigan Pure Opportunity.
Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. Gordon Deal with Jennifer Koshenko. Coming up this half hour, things we won't be able to live without in the year 2035. Also, how Instagram is turning some obscure American destinations into social media darlings. And the 11-year-old who helped a police officer tie his shoelaces during the 4th of July parade in Arlington, Texas. That story in about 20 minutes. Well, we've had the One Ring phone scam, the fake IRS phone calls, the scam that tricks you into thinking that your Social Security number has been connected to some car in Texas involved with running drugs. And now we have the Can You Do Me a Favor email scam. It's a story by Susan Tompor, personal finance columnist at the Detroit Free Press. Susan, what's trending?
Well, you know, it sounds kind of goofy, but what the scammers are doing is they're doing a lot of social engineering, and they are figuring out who's your boss. So you might get an email from someone who looks just, you know, right name as your boss. It might come from a Gmail account. It might not come from your corporate account. So you need to look at where it comes from. But the boss might say something as simple as, I'm really busy. I need your help right now. Are you available? We've gotten some of these at our workplace as it is, and I spoke with a 31-year-old woman out of state here who said she just started a job in April. She was from Miami, and she didn't think twice when she got an email from her boss asking for help. Her boss was on vacation, but he said he was going to be working remote. Here again, they may get some of this from Facebook. They may know it's spring break. You don't know, but they do sound plausible. They do sound like, yes, the boss is on vacation. So she wasn't taken aback when he said he needed $400 or $500 gift cards. This was going to be for a bonus for workers or some kind of prizes. So she went out and bought these, and, of course, he's having her read the numbers on the back. She bought 2 Best Buy gift cards and 2 Target gift cards. But then at some point she caught herself and started thinking, why is the boss asking for even more gift cards? Well, of course, she's already out $2,000 by the time she figures this out,
right,
because the crook's got the codes on the back of the gift cards. Some people do catch it. I heard from one person locally who had bought the gift cards but somehow figured it out and then was trying to sell off some of the gift cards to, people who used them. Some of them use the Steam gift cards. Some of them use the iPhone gift cards. So that person was out the money but, was looking for friends or whatever who would buy the cards from her to kind of help her not lose money on this deal.
So the first woman from out of state, she wound up, I guess, engaging the scammer in emails, right? She emailed back and said, here are the codes, basically, and they drained them.
Right, right. Once you acknowledge the email, and say, okay, I'm not busy, what do you need? That's when they will ask you for the gift card. So the best thing to do is obviously reach out to your boss by his email or her email and say, hey, do you really need me? Did you just email me about something? What can I do? Instead of hitting respond. So many of us are so rushed. We're doing about 3 million things. People are answering their emails while they're in their car, driving to work, driving to do something, driving an errand. So they know we're busy, so they know how to target us, But once you respond, that's when you do get into some trouble.
It's essentially emailing a stranger money. We're speaking with Susan Tompor, personal finance columnist at the Detroit Free Press, part of the USA Today Network. We're talking about the latest scams, which might come with an email to you saying, can you do me a favor? And it appears it's from your boss. So this one woman who spent like $2,000, she's out the money. Personally,
out the money. Fortunately, her family said, they'll help her out. Her husband, I guess she was telling me, offhand that, she was going to have a child. She was pregnant. So she said to her husband, hey, I'm pregnant. Don't get too mad at me, but this is the dumb thing I did. It just happens. Yep. You will be out the money. There's no way of getting money back on a gift card, which is why the scammers love using them.
Thanks, Susan. Susan Tompor, personal finance columnist at the Detroit Free Press. It is 21 minutes now in front of the hour on This Weekend. Thanks for joining us. We all thought we'd have flying cars by the end of last century, but we are due to be up to our armpits in them, apparently by the end of next decade, if the impressive number of trials continues to go well. So says tech analyst Rob Enderle, who's written a piece about things we won't be able to live without by the year 2035. Rob, like drone drop landings.
Amazon's already started to test drone delivery, and there's drone delivery going on that's active in other parts of the world. The issue, of course, with drones is where do they put the package where it's safe? If somebody just sees a drone flying over the package and they drop it in your driveway or your front lawn, they're just going to grab the package and walk off with it. You could certainly drop it in the person's backyard, but you have to worry about power lines and other stuff that's floating around in the backyard that the drone may not be able to see and might crash into. Plus, you might have pets that the package might flatten, so that's not good either. Ideally, you need a place that's secure that the drone can just drop off the package, someplace that's sheltered, where a sudden wind isn't going to blow the drone into the side and wreck the drone and damage your goods. So that's part of what I think is going to come is a designated place at your house, especially if you live in a high rise, where the drone can drop the package and you can get to the baggage.
All right. Another thing you said we won't be able to live without in 15, 16 years, autonomous ride-sharing car harbors.
Yeah, where does the car go once it drops you off? You don't want them just circulating all the time, plus they're going to need to charge. Most of these things are electric. And so you want them off the road. Well, they're going to need to go someplace. Ideally, of course, that would be a parking garage, and those things exist. And quietly, some of these companies are buying up these parking garages, I think in the hope that somebody's going to get to critical mass before they're going to need it. But in those parking garages, there'll be chargers, likely inductive chargers, so the cars can go in and charge until they're called on and can be made ready. But right now, what you wouldn't want is, thousands of these things just roaming the streets. trying to pick people up, because you just have gridlock all the time, every place, and nobody would go any place. So you do need the place to park them and charge them.
We're speaking with Rob Enderle, tech analyst, principal, and founder of the Enderle Group, and we're talking about things you won't be able to live without in the next 15 years or so. How about the number four on your list here, the autonomous traffic control?
Well, yeah, so you've got vehicles floating around. Mostly I'm more concerned than about the flying vehicles, I think, than the rolling ones. But you need some type of traffic control so that you can coordinate all the vehicles that are traveling every place. And also so you can make sure that none of the cars are being used in a hostile fashion. I mean, remember, we've had car bombs for some time. This would be a way to do a car bomb where you wouldn't have to worry about the driver being killed. It would just be land-based or up there flying, a flying low-cost drone with explosives. And so you need somebody overseeing this. If a vehicle's acting strangely, if somebody's hacked a vehicle, if a vehicle goes off the reservation, or simply if you just wanted to manage traffic at scale, you might use computers to do that. In fact, you probably will have to at scale. But at the end of the day, you're going to have to do some coordination. Just doing peer-to-peer isn't going to be good enough. You're going to have somebody overlooking the entire environment and determining if things are happening properly, if you've got excessive congestion, so maybe you can reroute, or if there's a vehicle that's acting in a hostile fashion, or if somebody just got into a car, overrode the autonomous capability of it, now drunk and is now driving crazy. So all of that stuff would need to be managed by some oversight.
Number five on your list, biometrics identity theft protection.
Yeah, well, we've got a lot of concern about facial recognition, and it's funny for me because if you've got a picture up on the web, your face has already been scanned by one of these programs. It's too late. We're now talking about closing the barn door long after the horses ran off and died. But the issue now is, what if you've been misidentified? There was a college student that got arrested because somebody had stolen his credit card, gone into a store and stolen something, and was identified as him. And as that person went out and stole their stuff, he got a criminal record, and he wasn't doing squat. So that there needs to be a protection in place so that if you are misidentified by biometrics and that person is going out and doing you harm, that gets identified before you end up in jail. So that's the part that I don't think we spend enough time with, is if you get misidentified by one of these programs, making sure that you aren't put in jail or otherwise punished for something that other person that is now carrying your identity did.
Thanks, Rob. Tech analyst Rob Enderle, principal and founder of the Enderle Group. 13 minutes now in front of the hour on This Weekend. Thanks for spending time with us. Across the U.S., people with smartphones are converging on picturesque attractions that many learned of on social media. The teeming crowds are creating problems that range from traffic to trash to even deaths. People have fallen while taking pictures at places like the Grand Canyon and Yosemite. California's Big Sur Coast and Colorado's Hanging Lake have been soiled by trampling of vegetation and discarded human waste. More on the Instagram phenomenon, which also has its benefits, from Wall Street Journal reporter Jim Carlton. Jim, the numbers are staggering.
Gordon, it's really just off the charts, the impact of social media in some of these places. So there's a place called Horseshoe Bend, Arizona, and it's beautiful. It's where the Colorado River kind of winds around a giant sandstone like monolith. And say 10 years ago, only 40,000 people a year would go there. Right now, it's 2 million. And the reason for the explosive growth is basically people start putting it on Instagram, look at this place, look at this place, and just kind of it grew exponentially. So this is like literally like a Disneyland plopping down in the backyard of the nearest town. It's really caused quite a bit of problems.
Yeah, and it's easy to find, because as long as somebody indicates where they are, you can click the Instagram page and a map automatically comes up and shows you where it is. How do the parks accommodate that from 10,000 to 2 million people? What do they do?
Well, I mean, they weren't ready for this at all. I mean, for example, there was no real parking lot. It was just like a dirt, pull off. And it was, I mean, literally people that knew about it were locals. And they would just kind of pull off the road and go up there. But then suddenly tour buses were coming, cars. They were lining both sides of the highway, which is a major highway, 65 miles an hour, people speeding, from the Utah border to Flagstaff. It's a miracle. Some people haven't been killed out there on the highway. highway. But so the city of Page, Arizona, which is nearby, they spent $4 million to build a 350-space parking lot. So that's one thing. The Page Police Department had to go out and do crowd control on busy weekends. The National Park Service, they had to put in a guardrail because so many people were right on the edge of the cliff. So it's, they've really had to pump in a lot of money.
Boy, and that the 350-car parking lot at times still isn't enough, right? Didn't you say sometimes traffic is still backed up for a couple of miles just waiting to get in?
It was a nightmare. Memorial Day weekend, on Memorial Day, the parking lot filled up within, like, you know, before the morning was done, and people were in the traffic jam. Extended 2 miles all the way back into the, like a Walmart in Page, and they had to call the police. They had to have, you know, traffic control. You know, I don't know about fist fights, but I mean it was pandemonium basically.
Thanks, Jim. It's Wall Street Journal reporter Jim Carlton. It is 6 minutes now in front of the hour on this weekend. Hey, glad you're with us. We'll finish with this. Aside from the fireworks, there was one moment that became a 4th of July favorite in Arlington, Texas. CBS News has the story of an 11-year-old named Joshua Brown who came to the aid of Officer Jerick Wilson during the annual Independence Day parade there. Mr. Wilson was about to carry the American flag in the holiday parade when he noticed his shoe was untied. So he told another member of the color guard, who caught the eye of young Josh, and whispered, "Can you tie his shoe?" Josh saved the day with a double knot. Mr. Wilson really wanted to meet Josh, and over the long holiday weekend, he got his chance to say thank you to his own first responder. How fitting that Josh, by the way, says he wants to become a police officer when he grows up and stand in Officer Wilson's shoes one day. Arlington's police chief was quick to praise the youngster on Twitter, promising him a challenge coin for his good deed. Like many police departments, Arlington officers hand out ceremonial challenge coins to honor everyday people who go above and beyond. That'll do it for this hour. For Jennifer Koshenka, I'm Gordon Deal. Thanks for listening to This Weekend. As a small business owner, you need protection for your physical and financial assets. From general and professional liability insurance to business owners and commercial auto policies, GEICO can help. Go to geicocommercial.com for your free quote and see how much you could save today.